God is almighty. Why didn't he create a world full of happiness and devoid of pain? And obviously, he didn't do that. And so what's the explanation? I think that this question has a mistake, really, based on, and that is, it assumes a particular view of God's goodness, or of God's righteousness, you might say, in a sense. So in other words, it presupposes a philosophical theory that we call utilitarianism, that a good agent always acts to maximize happiness and minimize pain. So it assumes that what God is fundamentally about is aiming at some global outcome. That is, what he really cares about is not so much individual people as just the total quantity of happiness and of pain out there in the world. And that's not the Christian perspective. That is, from a Christian point of view, God is not a utility maximizer or happiness maximizer. He's rather a God of love. The word in the Greek is agape. That is, he cares about individual creatures, not about aggregate quantities of happiness or unhappiness. He loves us as individuals, not merely as parts of the whole. And so the first question really is focusing too much on what the whole world is like and assuming that God is a happiness maximizer, and that's just not the case. So it's based on a false, I think, presupposition about the nature of God. Now that raises then a second question, or second, I think, misconception, which is, well, if God cares about us as individuals, and he loves us as individuals, and he sees suffering and pain and disease occurring, why, if he's all-powerful, doesn't he just intervene to relieve the suffering of these individual creatures that he loves? And I think that's a fair question. Why doesn't he do that if he's loving and if he's all-powerful? Well, the simple answer to this question is that God is the creator, right? So he's created a world containing creatures, both animate and inanimate, with their own intrinsic natures. So God doesn't just create a kind of shadow boxing world where he's actually doing everything and he can control everything in a point case-by-case sort of way. Instead, he creates a world with creatures who have natures, and he allows those natures to express themselves, at least ordinarily, in most cases. So if a human being is a sort of animal that needs air, and water is the kind of substance that doesn't permit air to penetrate it in sufficient quantities, then people will drown if they are in too much water. God is just going to allow the water to have its nature, human beings to have their nature. Of course, a special case of this is a human free will. If we are created with free will, and human beings and exercising that free will sometimes do bad things. So this creating of a world imposes certain constraints on God's own actions. He can't create a world if he's going to intervene willy-nilly every time there's some threat of harm, suffering, pain to any of the creatures that he loves. He genuinely loves us. He loves the sparrow, as Jesus says, cares about its suffering. But he's not going to stop all hawks in mid-flight in order to protect that sparrow, because that would not respect the nature that he created. So any divine intervention has to be the exception rather than the rule, if God is going to be the creator of a real world. Now that raises another question, right? Which is, well, if that's true, then aren't you forced to say that miracles are impossible? So if God creates a world, then he has to respect the natures that he's created. Then doesn't that mean that he can never intervene in a way that would overwhelm that nature or do things that were beyond the powers of the natures that he's created? Can he, talk about the nature of water, and in the Exodus, God causes the water to separate from the Red Sea in such a way that it seems not the way water would ordinarily act. So how does that consistent with what I just said about God as the creator of natures? Well, I think the answer here is that no, miracles are possible, but only when they have some special justification as part of divine revelation, not for the sake of preventing pain or suffering to creatures. So Jesus performed lots of miracles of healing during his ministry when he was here on earth. Why doesn't he heal everybody? Well, because those healings that occurred when he was on earth had a special purpose. They were revealing to us what God really cares about and how much he loves us. And when Jesus is not there and some act of suffering doesn't, or a miraculous healing wouldn't serve that revelatory purpose, then God won't intervene. And as I said earlier, These interventions have to be the exception rather than the rule. It can't be the case that God just miraculously intervenes whenever any kind of suffering is at stake, because that would in effect abolish or nullify creation altogether. Now, I've been talking quite a bit about the natural world and how God has respect for the natural world. And you might think, oh, so then what you're really saying is that human suffering and illness and death and injury and so on are just themselves natural, right? And so God has to respect them. That's why he allows us to suffer, allows us to be injured, allows us to die ultimately, because it's just part of the cycle of life, and that's fine. That's perfectly normal and perfectly natural. No, I'm going to say, actually, that's not the case. Again, from a Christian point of view, at least, that's inaccurate. I take the first few chapters of Genesis, of the Bible, to be telling us that God did not intend, as part of his original creation, that human beings should die or be subject to illness and injury and other pain and other things of that sort. So these things came on after the creation of human beings as a divine reaction to human rebellion, to what we call sin, to human beings insisting on going their own way, committing spiritual and ultimately moral evil. The children of Adam and Eve, Cain kills Abel, and so on. And so, so God subjected human beings to the reign of death as a necessary evil, in response to the abuse of free will by human beings. And the idea here is that if God had not done that, if he'd allowed moral evil to have free reign with no death, the result would have been far worse. Right? Because death actually puts a limit to human evil, human wickedness, both because it frees the victim from torture through death, and it eventually means that any tyrant or any criminal is going to die, and will again, puts a limit to the amount of evil they could do. I mean, just imagine a world where the Nazis could have tortured and inflicted suffering on people for forever without any kind of limitation. That would clearly have been worse than a world in which, because of death, there's a limitation to human evil. Now, why did God place each of us in such a fallen, corrupted creation? In other words, here I am. I didn't sin, in Genesis 3. I didn't violate any original divine command. I just get conceived and born in this world that's already fallen and corrupted. How does that show any kind of love for me? Shouldn't God have put me in a world in which there was no such sin and no need for the reign of death to intervene as a necessary evil? Why me? Well, the problem here is that this question presupposes that I could have existed in just any old world whatsoever. That is, let's imagine a world where Adam and Eve existed. They were given free will. They didn't sin. There was no death. So everything was fine. Is that a world where I could exist, or would you exist? I doubt that very much, actually. I think that my personal identity is probably linked to the fact that I exist in this world, right? That I was conceived and born in a world in which the fall had happened. And for that matter, a world in which the Korean War had happened, and World War II, and World War I, and the Black Death, and so on. So all those things that went up to making the world, that in 1956, was a world in which Rob Koons was conceived into, all of that is sort of baked into my identity. And so it's not a failure of God's love for me, but he didn't put me in a better world because he couldn't put me in a better world. It would have been someone else. And again, the point I'm making here is that God is a God of love of individuals, of me. And so the reasonable question to ask is not why didn't God put me in a better world, but rather what has God done for me in this world, in the sort of world in which I was conceived? And the answer is he's done an awful lot for me, done wonderful things for me, many things that demonstrate his love for me. So that's the right kind of focus for us to have, the right kind of question for us to look at. Right, so I already talked about that. Now, we could also step back and say, well, okay, let's say that's true. But I couldn't have existed in a better world, so to speak. I was necessarily going to be, if I exist at all, I was going to exist in a world that was fallen with death and disease and so on. Still, of course, God could have just not created me at all. He could have created some other world where there was no evil and suffering, or for that matter, he could have created nothing at all. He could have just stopped, done no creating. And why, you know, if he loves us, why would he create us at all and put us in a world, or have us, if with the consequence that we would then be in a world that was involved suffering and evil? And indeed, many people might turn to evil and be eternally separated from God. Why would God create us under those, that possibility, or even under that certainty? Well, here, the problem, this question, I think, is it's really is asking something that we human beings can't wrap our minds around. So it makes sense for us to look at specific actions of God that are similar to human actions. So, for instance, if God reveals himself and inspires a text, which is a sort of letter from God to us, then that's similar to human letter writing, right? And we can ask, well, was God truthful? Did he make promises that he kept? Is he trying to encourage us to be good people? You know, we can evaluate that action in human terms. You might say the Old Testament, the covenant with Israel, was a kind of human action where God was in effect acting as though he were some king in the Middle East in the first millennium BC. And we can ask, well, how good a king was he, right? What was the covenant that he made with his people? But when we turn to creating the world out of nothingness, we've got an action that's completely different from any conceivable human action. There's just no way for us to evaluate that as to whether that was a good action or a right action for God to do. Should he have created anything at all? We can't ask that question. We can't compare God's actions to human actions in such a way that particular action, especially in such a way that we can really apply our ordinary moral categories to it. I mean, remember, when God creates the world, he has no prior obligations and he has no relationships, right? He doesn't love anyone, but the three persons love each other. There are no creatures to love. There are no creatures to owe anything to. And so, again, all of our moral categories just don't apply to that kind of situation. We can't ask if God loved us, would he have prevented all of us from existing? It doesn't make sense. We can only, again, ask how God's actions subsequent to creation display his goodness and his loving kindness. So we can ask, given that he's created this sort of world, how has he shown his love to us in this world that he made? That's a sensible question, I think. But the other question just doesn't make any sense. Now, why didn't God create a better world? In a way, this is repeating my earlier question, but I just want to come back to it one more time. Couldn't God, even if God couldn't create or wouldn't have created a world where there was no suffering at all, couldn't he have made a somewhat better world than he did? A world with less suffering or less evil or something like that? He may have done so. I mean, it may be that at least some of the ranks of angels are such that none of them have ever sinned, like the seraphim, perhaps. And they just have this wonderful life. None of them have sinned, no evil, no death. Everything's really great. So the question is not why didn't God create such a world, because maybe he did. The question is why, in addition to such world, did he create our world, so to speak, our human world on the earth with its fall, with death and sin and so on? Well, I mean, why not, right? Is the world worse, that much worse, for having, in addition to all those really good worlds, worlds like ours that are flawed in various ways? I don't see any reason to think that he needn't do that. And from a point of view of there's the love of variety and of interesting creation, why not create worlds like ours where things have gone wrong in some ways, in addition to the worlds where everything goes right? I can't see an objection to that myself. Now, we might turn eighth then. We say, okay, so you're saying that God created many imperfect worlds. I say, yes, our world is an imperfect world. But wait, he's a perfect God. How could a perfect God create an imperfect world? Doesn't the imperfection of the world reflect back on the creator? I mean, in human terms, it often would. If somebody paints an imperfect painting, you say that's an imperfect painter, right? In human terms, that's quite a reasonable inference. However, in this case, it doesn't apply. That kind of inference doesn't apply because God is infinite and we're finite. So since God is infinite, this is something of a paradox. It's precisely because God's infinite that we should expect a highly imperfect creation. So not only is it not the case that imperfect creation means imperfect creator, I would say perfect creator means imperfect creation. It implies the imperfection of the creation. Now, why do I say that? Well, because if God is truly infinite, then there's no best possible world he could make. Any world he could create, he could have made a better one. So indeed, an infinite number of better ones. And so no matter what he created, we could always look at that world and say, well, that's relative to these other worlds. This is imperfect. This is not as great as he could have done. And that's just a consequence of the fact that God is infinite. It's unreasonable for us to think that God, being infinite, would create the best possible world he could. There's no such thing. There is no such thing as the best possible world an infinite being could create. Now, you and I are finite, and, you know, it might be reasonable for you to think, you know, Dr. Coons, you should teach the best possible philosophy course you can teach. I mean, I think that's actually pretty hard, but you might think, at least I could approximate the best course I could possibly teach. And maybe I should, but that's because I'm finite, and there really is such a thing as the best course I could teach. There's no such thing as the best creation God could make. And so it's totally unreasonable for us to say that God should do that or even approximate that. It just doesn't make sense. This is related to a notion that I've been developing recently, and I'm a little nervous about this. You could argue this is a bit blasphemous, perhaps, for me to say that God is, in a certain sense, indolent. But nonetheless, I think there's some truth to this. That is, given that God is infinite, and there's an infinite number of things that he could do, but all of which are good, and which are not mutually consistent, this means that God must fail to do lots of good things for no reason at all. Right? We often look at something and say, why didn't God do better? He must have had some reason. I want to say no, actually. In most cases, he has no reason whatsoever for not doing things better, because he can't always do things better, right? I mean, he has to do something, and there will always be better things he could have done for no particular reason. All that we can really predict is that since God is perfect and God is innocent, everything he does will be good. He will create good things. He will reveal himself in good ways, but we can't say that he will do all possible good things. And that if he doesn't do some possible good thing, he must have had some reason for not doing it. You mean he won't have, in many cases, any reason for not doing good things. An infinite God can never do all the good he's capable of. So God needs no reason not to do good things. That's just the default. That's just the way things work. What he can say is that he always will do good things, right? Often amazingly good things. But you can't say that he'll do all possible good things. That's reasonable. It never makes sense for us to ask, why didn't God do more? In many cases, there's just no answer to that question. We shouldn't expect that there would be an answer. Now, this is true. It actually has some interesting practical consequences, if I'm right about this. It makes sense, then, for us to try to give God special reasons for actualizing particular goods. So in other words, in many cases, he won't do anything for no particular good reason. We might be able to give him some good reasons for doing the good thing that it otherwise wouldn't do. I mean, people often think that our prayers can't make any difference to God, our petitionary prayers. Because after all, wouldn't God automatically do all the good things anyway? No, actually, he wouldn't. He'll do good things, but he won't do all the good things. And through our prayers, we can make it the case that he does some good things he otherwise wouldn't do. He might heal someone that he otherwise wouldn't have healed because our prayers gave him a reason for doing that in a way that goes beyond just the fact that it's a good thing. It's just an additional reason. Now, again, there's no guarantees. We can't coerce God into action. In certain cases, God might have a good reason not to answer our prayer. But nonetheless, there's really good reason, I think, for us to engage in prayer in order to encourage God, so to speak, to do additional good things. Now, since God is constrained to respect created nature, and because God is indolent in my sense, because of his infinity, in many cases, it's up to us to fight against suffering, right? I mean, God does deal with suffering in many cases through us, by encouraging us and commissioning us to heal the sick and to care for those who are dying and so on. And God will cooperate with and bless our efforts in these ways. But this fact solves the dilemma that Albert Camus poses in The Plague, where, you know, there's a plague in this little North African town, and the priest is worried. He thinks, what can I really fight against the plague? Because obviously the plague must be God's will. If God didn't think that the plague was a good thing, he wouldn't have allowed it. So maybe I shouldn't actually fight it. My answer is no, yeah, you should fight the plague. And it would have been, it's a good thing for the plague not to happen, but there's no reason to think that God has some special reason for allowing this plague, right? It's just that it's part of the creation that he made, and he just decided not to make a better world. But, you know, the plague is bad, and we should fight it. And he'll bless us if we do fight it, right? He'll bless us if he takes steps to do something with this. So in terms of looking at God's grace, again, I'm not saying that in calling God indolent, I'm not saying that he's done amazing things for us. I'm just asking that we stop focusing on what God hasn't done. What we should do instead is we should focus on what God has done, right? And thank him and be grateful for those good things, all the good things he showers on us daily, of which we take so many of them for granted. And of course, as Christians, we believe he took the extraordinary step of assuming our own human nature, becoming a man, Jesus, living and dying in great shame and pain, all of which to overcome our separation from him in various ways. So tremendous things that he's done for us and offers to us as demonstrations of his love and at great cost to himself. My last question is, how can suffering have any positive meaning for us? If in many cases, there really is no reason why the suffering happens other than a kind of natural reason, that there's some virus that causes it, let's say, then how can it have any meaning for us? It looks like it's just some absurd thing that happens. Well, that's not, I think that's the case, because in fact, God himself conquered evil through the suffering of his son, Jesus on the cross. And we can participate in God's warfare with evil by patiently enduring the suffering that we find and by that we have to suffer and by acting compassionately. So we can use the suffering as opportunities, basically, to cooperate with God, to become vehicles of God's love to other people. So it's possible for us to turn suffering into through God's help into something positive. And of course, we have hope for eternal life, which will be free from pain and suffering, in which we and others can enjoy the fruits of our current struggles. And so that's always very encouraging, even in the midst of suffering for us. Okay, just to conclude, I wanted to real briefly, in a way this goes back to my first slide again, go through the so-called Lucretian problem of evil. Lucretius was an important Roman philosopher of the first century AD, and he produced an argument which you hear a lot. I mean, you hear this from almost all modern-day atheists as well. It's called the problem of evil, or the Lucretian problem of evil. If God exists, then he's wholly good and omnipotent, all-powerful. A holy good God would want to actualize the best possible world. I mean, if he's good, why not the best world? The best possible world would be a world with no bad things at all. Just get rid of all the bad things. But an all-powerful God could actualize any world. An all-powerful God could make a world with no bad things in it. But there are bad things, right? And so we've got here a logically valid argument. If these five premises are correct, we would be able to conclude that God does not exist. Right? If he exists, he's going to be good and all-powerful. But if he's good, he'd want to make the best world. If he's all-powerful, he could make the best world. But this isn't the best world, because we have evil in it. So that's the nature of the argument. Now, in response to this argument, I would not disagree with the first premise or the fifth premise. I would say, yes, it's true that if God exists, he's going to be wholly good and all-powerful. That's just built into what it is to be God. And I would not deny that bad things exist. There really are bad things. They're not just an illusion or something like that. But nonetheless, I think all the other premises in this argument are faulty, 2, 3, and 4. I would just reject all of them. Would a holy good God want to actualize the best possible world? Well, first of all, there is no best possible world, as I said. He could always create a better world, given any world whatsoever. And in any case, he's not aiming at creating worlds anyway. He's just interested in loving particular people. So this premise is just completely off base. Would the best possible world be a world completely devoid of bad things? It's not obvious that that's the case. You know, the world would be, why not have a world in which some bad things happen, just as a part of the greater diversity and variety of being? Not obviously anything bad about that. And can an omnipotent God actualize any world? Well, yes and no. I mean, he can't make logical contradictions true. So he can't make a world in which water acts mostly in a watery way and then make it not act in a watery way all the time, right? He can't have his cake and eat it too, even if he's all powerful. He can't give us free will and then never allow us to exercise that free will in a way that's contrary to his own intentions. That wouldn't make any sense. So there are, you know, constraints even on God, as I mentioned. Okay, so the principle of analogy, I want to say something about this real briefly. Again, God is infinite, we're finite. That means that goodness has a different sort of operational meaning in the two domains. So what it is for God to be good and what it is for us to be finite creatures to be good is somewhat different, not completely unrelated. If it were completely unrelated, it would be like God could be the devil, right? God could be completely bad and still be good or something. And I'm not saying that. But nonetheless, analogy says that although there's a relationship, there's basically, they are fundamentally the same, God's goodness and our goodness, there's still a difference you have to take into account when you're thinking about an infinite being and a finite being. So again, as I mentioned earlier, if God's action is similar to ours, like making promises to the people of Israel, or when he becomes a human being, assumes human nature, and does and says things as Jesus in Nazareth, then we can apply moral standards with confidence, right? We can look at Jesus and say, is Jesus a good man, a good human being? Yes. That tells us something about God. But when God's action is radically different from our actions, like creation ex nihilo, creation from nothingness, we just can't apply our moral categories. It doesn't make any sense for us to say, was that a good act, other than just to say it's a God act, right? There's no further standard we can apply. So again, just to summarize real quickly what I've said, first of all, there are self-imposed constraints. God places himself under certain fixed constraints, like policies of non-interference. And this is really just built into creating a world at all. There's no best possible world given God's infinity. He's necessarily indolent. There's always lots of better things he could do but didn't do. And the fragility of personal identity. If God had made a better world, then we wouldn't have been in it. And so God did not show any lack of love for us in not making that better world, right? Because we wouldn't be there. And his love for us presupposes that we exist. And we exist in this sort of world, this kind of fallen, imperfect world. Apart from Jesus, I think there is no compelling evidence of God's love. We can say that God's good, we can prove that. You can't really prove that God is love apart from what he's revealed to us, I think, in the gospel of Jesus. So Jesus is really important because he transposes God's character into the human key so that we can appreciate and understand it and relate to God in terms of his love. And in terms of our own response, human death and suffering are not part of God's original design. They resulted from human rebellion. So death and human suffering are bad things, and we can fight them as bad things. Jesus' passion and death gives meaning to all suffering. He became a human being in order to reach us in our wickedness, and this required him to suffer at our hands in order to reveal both our wickedness and his goodness. And by bearing our suffering patiently and by working to relieve the suffering of others, we can unite ourselves with Jesus' sacrifice. And so our suffering can have a certain meaning. And of course, we look forward to an eternal life in which these struggles are rewarded with an unimaginably great surplus. So there'll be a compensation for any of the sufferings that we undergo.